It's Wednesday, October 6th. This is Philosophy 201, Ethics, Fall 2010. And we've been talking about moral skepticism. So, any thoughts about Glaucon last time? What answers could we say to Glaucon? What's Glaucon's challenge? And remember, Glaucon's playing devil's advocate. He doesn't really believe any of the things that he's saying. But what is Glaucon saying? Yes?
He basically said injustice was good and justice was bad.
Mm-hmm. Injustice is better than justice. Why is injustice good? Most people say injustice to me. If you say injustice is good, people think that's weird. And you think justice is bad, you think that's weird too. Yeah.
And it tends to benefit the self-interest
of the injustice. Yeah, it benefits the individual. Now you say selfish, that sounds kind of judgmental. You say that injustice is not in your... Injustice is usually in your interest. Because injustice means you get to get what you want regardless of what how it affects other people. And so, stealing. Why do people steal? Do people say, I'm going to steal? Why? Because it's evil and because my goal is to commit evil acts. People who steal don't say, I want to be evil, so I'm going to steal stuff. It's like, I want this stuff, but I don't want to work for it, therefore I'm going to take it, right? And I'm going to try not to get caught. So people who steal stuff are motivated by self-interest, and stealing means taking what you want without having to pay for it. And who doesn't like free stuff, right? And so it's free as long as you don't get caught and then you have to pay. And, you know, sometimes crime does pay.
I think I heard somewhere that theft is a crime of opportunity, essentially. Like, if the harder it is to take something, the more deterred someone would be, you know, in relation to how much they want it.
Yeah, it's kind of like, pirating music and movies and stuff like that. Like, if there's, like, a big penalty or it's, like, really hard to do, people won't do it. If it's like, if you just go on the internet and just, you know, click something and it downloads, and you can get on these file-sharing sites and there's, like, a million people with the song you want, and you just click a button, why would you go with iTunes and pay 99 cents for it? You know, maybe you want like a whole bunch of songs, and that 99 cents adds up for a while. So you just go on, like people used to use Napster before they went to a pay service, and now there's still all these file sharing sites, and people just go on there and download music for free instead of being chumps and suckers and actually paying for something they can get for free. And so Glaucon says that sacrifice is bad, and what are things that are good? Well, people like money, people like sex, people like power. People want freedom, and what does justice require you to do? Give your money to other people, waste your time helping people, respecting other people's rights when their rights are getting in the way of what you want. And that's his argument. Now, what can we say to him? Well, Plato actually has an answer to him through Socrates, and so give you Plato's answer. Plato says, through his spokesperson Socrates, injustice is a disharmony of the soul. Where the desiring part overcomes the rational part. And you become like a beast. And you've heard people say this. They'll say that, you know, that animal should be put down, right? Like there's a story about these in the news about these two guys who Nancy. They held this company, this family at gunpoint. They tied up the father and like beat the hell out of him. They had two daughters, which one was like 7, the other one was 13. So they took the mom to the bank to withdraw like a whole bunch of money. And they got back to the house and they raped the mother and one or both of the daughters. And then like the daughters were tied to the bed and then they like lit the house on fire and the daughters, they didn't burn to death, but they died of smoke inhalation. So they killed his family and the father managed to untie himself and, you know, get away. And so most people look at those guys and they say, those men, they're not really even human. They're like animals. They're just running on their animalistic impulses for sex, for power, and they brutalize other people. And they're sort of like the pitiless lion who tears open the soft underbelly of the gazelle and doesn't care that the gazelle is in agony and thrashing around and just, you know. And that you don't want to be around people like that. And you wouldn't want to become like this. To become a person like Glaucon suggesting, who prizes injustice and looks down their nose at justice, is to become like an animal. It's to sublimate your rational capacity to understand that other people have rights like you, to have human sympathy and so on. Although he doesn't really think about it as being an emotional thing, but it's more of a rational thing where you are in control of your base impulses, your animal instincts. Your animal instincts aren't ruling you. And on one way of thinking about this, he basically says your animal instincts rule you. And for Plato, that's the worst thing to happen, because what's the most important part of you is your mind, and he thinks that reason should be in charge, and he describes reason as a charioteer who holds the reins of desire and makes sure that the horses go where he wants them to go. Otherwise, you're sort of like a psychopath going around looking for people to victimize.
How would you rationalize, in modern times, like white-collar criminals, like people who benefit from elaborate Ponzi schemes or mobsters, people who are obviously not irrational or illogical people, but are in fact really capable and intelligent, but still unjust?
You mean like FTR and his Social Security scheme?
Sure.
Just think about you say elaborate Ponzi scheme, that's the first thing that comes to mind. But yeah, what about white-collar criminals? You're saying they use their reason to
yeah. They may even think that they're good people, you know, themselves, but they're committing things that, you know, objectively say are pretty unjust, like taking money from destitute people.
Like Plato might say that although they're using rational means, they're still being driven by animal desires like greed and lust for power, and so even though the means is a little different than, like, you know, it's he might say that it's no different from the crafty criminal who like lies in wait, you know, with his duct tape and his guns and his knives and his torture instruments or whatever, that lurking around the house and knows how to, like, you know, like he has this little suction cup with a little glass cutter where he can open the window. So I mean, he's clever, but he's being driven by this bloodlust. Or in the case of the Wall Street, you know, huckster, or the you know, the greedy banker, whoever your villain is, you know, the white collar criminal, their elaborate scheme that, you know, Bernie Madoff as the big Ponzi scheme guy, even though he's using all this complicated ruse, it's still that he's lusting after material possessions, right? He lived for comfort and ease and living in wealth and luxury, and those are animalistic things, according to Plato. And it's bad to live your life as an animal. Yeah.
So kind of a good natural metaphor then for that would be like, no matter how beautiful it looks, a spiderweb is still a death trap.
Trying to think of the analogy. What's analogous to the beauty?
Well, like people talking about how crafty these schemes are, how intricate they are, uh-huh. how well designed they are,
right.
But they still have an end means, which is to take advantage.
Yeah, I mean that's right. So that's Plato's answer. Now, what do you think about this as an answer? Criminals are sick.
criminals are sick, you might say, you know, insane, right? It's they have an unbalanced minds. They're, you know, vicious. The sort of rabid dogs. Think about this. Why? Because they let their desires drive them. And that's why they would do things to other people. But then the question is like, this is maybe, I don't know, is this, do you find this convincing or what do you think? Yeah.
I feel like you kind of are animals and you're like, I don't know what really separates us, like just because we know that we can communicate with each other.
The philosopher Nietzsche said that his goal in life was to return man to his rightful place with the beasts, and that society, particularly religion, had softened man and made him weak and impotent, and had pulled the wool over his eyes into thinking that he was different from an animal. And that really human being, and Nietzsche kind of argued for kind of morality of predators. Nietzsche might not necessarily disapprove of what criminals might do. Yeah.
I disagree with him using the beast as a lower form than man, because the lion doesn't intend to inflict pain for no reason. It's only killing to feed itself.
Well, same thing with the bank robber. You know, that's Willie Sutton famously was asked, Willie, why do you rob banks? And you remember what he said? That's where the money is. Right? So it's, you know, you're looking for some sort of deep reason about why criminals would commit crimes. Because they want stuff and they don't want to have to work for it. And you might say a lot of criminals are dumb. They're just that, or, so they maybe they're not smart enough to get as much money as they want, so they cut corners, or maybe they don't have to wait as long for it. Although some criminals, you actually get people that sort of get fixated on getting something for nothing, and if they would have just like gone into business, they might have been successful business people. But they're always looking for some con to do. So they turn their like, you get these hackers, right, that are really brilliant with computers, and they're really into hacking because it's, you know, against the law and it's dangerous. But if they would have gone into computer science, they might, you know, have all the money they want. Anyway, so this is Plato's answer. Your mileage might vary on this. How about some other things? What about like karma? We might get into this a little bit of my answer. What comes around goes around. Is that true? Or crime doesn't pay. Yeah.
If we discount reincarnation, I would say that it's false. But I don't know how much justice, you know, karma would give if you know, the actual, what we define as the person that did the crime, you know, maybe their soul or whatever went on to live again. But obviously this person has no recollection of what they've done. And, you know, like, it's kind of like the kind of clean slate kind of, why should they get punished for something that someone else did, essentially, even though they have the same soul?
Yeah, so if you're dealing with reincarnation, then the question about is it really the same person if they have a whole different memory and personality and so on? Well, just like think about, a lot of people think about karma as something that happens in the same lifetime. Does it seem to you that, like, if you do something wrong to someone else, or is something bad going to happen to you in return? Yeah.
I always try to believe in some sort of line like that, but I've done a lot of good things that have never been rewarded, so I don't know if it's in the next lifetime that I'm getting all these rewards from all these good deeds I've done in this life. But
know, like you're talking about finding somebody's wallet, you return it to them, well, the money's out of it, so they look at you like you're the thief that stole the
right.
wallet when you were nice enough to call them up and return the wallet.
No good deed goes unpunished as the... Yeah, sometimes people try to do the right thing and they end up having paying a penalty for that, for getting involved or trying to help someone. They end up, the person ends up turning on them in some way. Or the person takes advantage of them. I remember, I'll tell you what a sucker I was. After I divorced my first wife, she was looking for a job and had to take the bus to find a job, and I felt sorry for her, and she's like, could you just like, you have a credit card still, oh, mine had been taken away, my credit, so you could rent me a car, and I could find a job really fast, and I could be able to, you know, like pay you back, and I was like, oh, all right, so I did it, and so that, you know, I rented a car, and like the next week, I think I rented for a week, and then the car company calls me, and they say, you know, did you want the car for another couple of days, sir? And like, it was supposed to be back on Friday. And it turns out that she, I had to play detective to track down what happened to this car. She took off with this gang member, and they went up to Oregon, actually. I was living in California at the time. They went up to, they're in the Hillsboro area. And, I found all her friends. I was driving around town trying to see where she'd gone, and I'd heard that she'd hooked up with this guy and what his name was. I just got his first name, and then I heard they told me he worked at McDonald's, so I went to like all the McDonald's in the area until I found out that, oh yeah, this guy worked here for 3 weeks and he just took off without any explanation. And by the way, we found out he has a criminal record. So like, okay, so then I end up getting the guy's parole officer. You know, long story short, you know, he calls me at my house, and he's like, call my parole officer, call my family, I'm going to come down there, I'm going to cut you, man. And so like, just like, so I got this guy threatening me with my life. I'm like worried about being liable for this car. I'm like, you know, I'm trying to move, and I got all this drama going on. I'm like, oh God, I'm going to have to pay for like this brand new car. And I filed a police report and saw an attorney about what my liability, just like this whole mess, just because I was trying to help out somebody who needed some help, and I ended up being a sucker again.
It's a good story.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, it's crazy. I still like, you know, I can still remember it. It's like, you know, on the phone trying to like cajole my wife into bringing the car back, and what it ended up like. It ended, this guy, this gang member guy, he ended up getting into a fight with someone outside a 7-Eleven store and being arrested by the cops. And his fellow gang members ended up like joyriding in a car and crashing it somewhere and vandalizing it. It was just totaled. Luckily, I filed a police report, and so I didn't end up paying. So it's just, but you know, that was just, and this just all came from me saying, oh gosh, you know, my wife, I know she's had her problems, but she like seems really optimistic and has been riding the bus, you know, and trying to find a job, and she could, you know, fill out more applications and go more places if she just had a car for a week, and it's only $200, you know, okay. And it just blew up in my face, right? And you probably, most people in this room have, it may be lesser experiences where something like that had happened, where you try to do a favor to someone, just, you know. So, ideally what you want is you want to be the person that, like, takes off with the rental car, right? Or at least you want to, like, at least you don't want to be a sucker, but at least, you know, you want other people to do nice things for you. Now, it might be you have a reciprocal relationship where you do nice things for some people, they do nice things for you, you have this sort of relationship, and then, you know, when they're no longer useful to you, you stab them in the back, you know? That's what Glaucon would suggest, right? You kind of talk, kind of like the way Hollywood works, right? You know, you sort of you make friends with people who are useful to you.
You're also asking about how people, or in the reading here, was talking about you are what people think you are rather than who you really are. Yeah, your reputation. And I have a little story. I don't want to get carried away with it, but I'd done a job for a guy, and then the next year I came back to winterize this irrigation system, and I got a call about 2 weeks later from him asking me to come over, and I did. And he said, well, we have all this jewelry missing, and we think, you know, you took it. And I said, well, what's your theory? I said, why? He goes, well, they saw my truck there the day before, which I wasn't there. I had witnesses that saw me there, and all this stuff. And, you know, I'm like, well, geez, he says he's going to call the cops. You know, I said, well, what do you want me to do? And he says, well, I want you to return the jewelry and pay me $7,600, you know, the value of it. And I had spent all this time working on this project, late at night there, 11 o'clock, with lanterns, having dinner with them, talking about all this stuff. And I just was so offended that they would think this. And it ended up being, I went home and I thought, well, you know, give me whatever information you have, and I'll try to help you find who took this stuff. But I went home and called my attorney. I said, man, I'm going to jail. These guys have witnesses that saw me there. I worked there and all this. It was bizarre. And
you're there working your ass off, right? Yeah. Trying to help the guy.
A couple weeks later, he called me back, and they found the jewelry. His wife had stashed it under the bathroom sink. They were paving outside, and she stashed it so that it wouldn't be exposed. And she was still trying to convince me that you weren't here then that day? And I was like, you know, you found the jewelry, now you're still trying to convince yourself that part of this story that they schemed was accurate. And my whole point was about, you know, what you think you look like to yourself and what somebody else portrays you at is two different things.
Yeah, you might end up being like a good guy, but you cross the wrong person and you end up being smeared. That's why, you know, people that run for office, you'll get like an honest person, you know, running for political office to try to root out corruption. But then, like, the corrupt guys that are in there, whoever they're running against that wants to hold on to the power, they're just going to, like, try to dig into every little, you know, thing they did back when they were in high school and just try to make them look as bad as possible. And then what do people think? They think about, like, the character of the media. They don't think about, like, what this person actually is. If you think about this concept of karma, people, I think this is a nice story. People like to tell themselves that what goes around comes around. But really, unless you're living in a small town, chances are if you do something bad to somebody else and you're kind of sneaky about it, it's not going to come back to you. And it's very extremely unlikely. And this idea there's some sort of magical force which is going to, you know, if you, you know, take something, like you find like a, I don't know, I keep on dealing with these found objects. So you find a wallet full of money and you pocket it, and it's like somebody was going to use it to get married. Oh, that's a bad use of the money anyway. I'm saving that person some... Maybe it leads to the wedding being called off. You think, I did him a favor. But you have like... you got like $5,000 in cash and you can spend it on yourself. And you're thinking, well, that's great. Is that going to lead to someone else taking money from you in the future? How would that be? What's the causal relationship? And you can look at empirically, right? You can think of lots of examples of people that live to ripe old ages, you know, screwing other people and treating other people terribly, and they still end up with like a lot of, you know, the finer things in life, right? Lots of money. They even got friends, and their friends are a bunch of bastards too, but it's sort of like the honor among thieves, right? They screw the other people, but not like their friends. You think about, like, I think about the example of Chairman Mao. Did I bring him up before? Attacked the same people. But Chairman Mao was, like, responsible for the deaths of, like, 50 million people, conservatively. So, apart from being, like, a commie and not knowing how an economy works, and, like, trying to take all the people from the city and put them out on farms and tell them to work in workers' cooperatives and having people starve to death as a result and killing off all the intellectuals and destroying priceless cultural treasures of China and just, abusing human rights and just all sorts of horrible human being. Also a child molester. He liked, like, they would bring peasant girls from the outskirts who were just around puberty, and he'd, like, you know, rape them, and just like a horrible person. He'd lionized by certain members of the current administration. You get people in the 60s would run around with Mao's little red book. But just like, if you had to put, you know, like Hitler here and you had Mao here, I'd say Mao was like a more evil person than Hitler. That would be my view. But you look at Mao, he lived to a ripe old age. You know, he had everything handed to him. He was still regarded as a great man. There's maybe a few people around that that think you know like the historical truth about him or think he's a bad guy. But it's not like Hitler. You know, Hitler, people think, oh, Hitler, Nazi's bad. But Mao somehow avoided the bad rap and is still revered in China to this day. And you get a lot of college professors who love Chairman Mao. And even there's even, I think there's still a display out in the case there with the Chairman Mao, you know, there's like a Chairman Mao alarm clock with all the workers saluting to him. And if I had like a picture of Hitler in there with like a bunch of Nazis and stuff, you know, people would scream bloody murder, but Mao's like seen as a good guy. So the long short of this Chairman Mao is that he lived to a ripe old age, even though he killed 50 million people and was a child molester and a horrible human being and persecuted intellectuals and destroyed priceless cultural treasures of China in the name of the revolution. So, you know, now if you believe in the afterlife, that might be a certain thing. But this idea of karma and that you're somehow going to be paid back for the bad things you did in this lifetime doesn't seem empirically true. And we'll get to the divine command theory next time. If you think God's going to punish you, that might be a reason to avoid doing wrong to other people. But that will be for next week.
Can I go into motivism?
Yeah, let's talk about emotivism. So, just to wrap up here, just a couple more things. So, you get karma, you get the idea crime doesn't pay. What about the idea that just you do better? How about this idea that honesty is the best policy? And that a person who lives with integrity and honor and the humanistic values of you know, respecting the rights of other people is going to do better on average than the person that's always looking for their angle and ways to screw the guy next to them to get the things they want in life. Yes, sir.
You're definitely going to get screwed over some of the time, but I think that the net gain in the end is going to be more than if you're just a subversive jackass who tries to screw everyone else over. Like, I mean, I think people, if you're like a nice guy to everyone, honorable, you help people out, you're honest, insured possessions, etc. I mean, yeah, someone might take advantage of your kindness a few times, maybe a lot, but you're still probably going to come out with a net gain greater than if you just were a miserable human being. And, you know, you'd probably be less happy, too, if you just treated everyone else like shit.
Sometimes people are super talented and they manage to get by with no social graces and being like a total you know, psychopath or you know, treating people horribly and having all sorts of weird quirks. And think about like the rock stars, you know, getting drunk, beating their girlfriends, tearing the walls out of hotel rooms. But you know, there's millions of people that love their music and so they can sort of escape. But for your average person, you know, those aren't the sort of traits that are going to help you win friends and influence people. So if you have talent coming out of your ears and you've already sort of, you know, you've made your place in the world, then maybe you can get by and treat other people like dirt. But if you're not in that position, you might say that what pays? Well, you know, things like integrity, responsibility, commitment, honor, honesty, things like courage. And courage is sort of, you know, not just sort of the physical courage, but this idea of having sort of ambition and being a go-to person and compassion. You know, self-control. Right? Controlling your temper. Controlling your base desires. Discipline. These are all kind of moral ideals. As opposed to like the criminal that has no self-discipline to show up to a 9-to-5 job. And he can't control his impulses. And if things get tough, he sort of, you know, ducks out and gives up or, goes on to something else. And so your typical criminal or your psychopath is going to try to sort of slink around in the shadows and try to, you know, work the system, or at least one kind of criminal is. But it seems that if you have these virtues, you know, the world's going to be your oyster. People are going to want to work with you. People are going to want to hire you. People are going to want to be your friend. And then if something bad happens to you, you're going to have a lot of people that say, "That Bardale, I heard his house burned down the other day. Oh, it's terrible. But yeah, you know, we're taking up a collection for him," or something like that, right? Or what have you. You have, you know, people want to help you. Or even if you, like, suppose, I get laid off at LCC. If I got a lot of friends, the friends are going to say, "Hey, you know, I heard about there's a job opening up at OSU. You should apply for it." Whereas, like, if I'm a total jerk and I don't have friends, nobody's going to, you know, try to help me out. So that might be one way of sort of trying to argue against CloudCon, is that maybe living a life of honesty and virtue and compassion is going to endear you to other people and is going to make you valuable to other people, and that's going to help you prosper and get all the things you want. You know, if you want to get, even if you want to attract, like, members of the opposite sex, right? That maybe that those sorts of things would be attractive to them. Not to be a person that blows their stack all the time and goes on rants and can't handle responsibility, right? I mean, all those things. What do you think? Good cases? Later on, we'll get to egoism, and this is why we'll look at Ayn Rand. Ayn Rand is an egoist. Ayn Rand says that your only duty is yourself, and your highest good is your own happiness. But she also thinks that somebody like Glaucon is wrong in what you should do. This is exactly what she says, that what will give you a good life, what will make you happy. What will make you happy is being a productive person and doing things that you find interesting or valuable or fulfilling that also happen to be the value of other people. It's not going around using force or fraud on other people, but it's in serving your own self-interest. But what she says is it never in fact in your interest to violate the rights of other people. That in the long run is going to be bad for you. One other thing you might say is that you can ask this question: what is intrinsically good? And Glaucon says it's money, sex, power. You might argue, well, maybe there's more to life than these things. Maybe these things aren't what's intrinsically good. Maybe what's good is, what might be some alternatives? Or maybe we might add this. Maybe those things are intrinsically good, but maybe we'd add some things. Money might blow down to something else, because there's nothing like intrinsically good about having little green slips of paper. Money actually is often used, or having little green slips of paper is seen as being sort of an extrinsic good, and often used as an intrinsic good. So, like, money is good for what you can get for it. You can exchange the little green slips of paper for goods and services. So what do you want the money for? You want the money to, you know, buy food, you'd say. And the food serves your health. And maybe health is intrinsically good. So maybe why you want to be healthy? Well, maybe to be happy. And maybe it all boils down to happiness. But then the question is, will these three things make you happy necessarily?
Freedom,
yeah. That might be good. Now, what about... you can think of a lot of people that have money, sex, and power, and they seem to be very happy. Look at, like, you know, Britney Spears, right? You know, what's the girl that's, this picture of her shooting heroin in that, Lindsay Lohan? Is that who it is?
Yep.
Yeah, these people, they're hooked on drugs, they've got money coming out of their ears, and they're driving their own cars while they're drunk. If I had that much money, I'd be right in the back of a limousine. I wouldn't be driving some crappy SUV. Oh, well, I was drunk with a baby on my arm. And I was so you get these people, and they're all screwed up, and they're shaving their heads, and they're just like acting crazy and hooked on drugs. Look at Elvis, right? He died, you know, popping pills, sitting in the toilet, right? What a way to go. And he was like the most famous, you know, one of the richest guys in the world, the most famous singer in the world, and he's got all these psychological problems and, you know, health problems and drugs. So maybe Glaucon's wrong. Maybe these things aren't, you know, what's going to make you ultimately happy. So that's one way I think you can attack Glaucon, is that he thinks that these sort of material things or a life of pleasure or power or wealth, that's what's going to make you ultimately happy. You might say, well, maybe that isn't what makes people happy. So just another way you might go. Let's talk about emotivism. So somebody tell me, what is emotivism? What form of emotivism is also known as non-cognitivism. What general theory is emotivism a part of? What general theory does it fall under? What are we studying this week? Moral skepticism, right? Yeah. So emotivism is a particular kind of moral skepticism. So moral skepticism doesn't say what morality is. It just says there ain't no such animal, or it's not really real, right? It's anti-realism. And so moral skepticism or moral anti-realism says morality is not real. But then the question is, why do people use words like just and unjust, and why do people say, oh, you shouldn't do that? Actually, often they don't even add because it's wrong. You say, you shouldn't do that. Or you know, I was treated unfairly. Or that's just not right. Right. People say things like that all the time. Why do they say these things, and why do people make moral judgments? And why do people call things good and evil, right and wrong? And so there's different theories about this, and one of these is David Hume's non-cognitivism. So Hume says, if you think about moral statements, and you take a statement like, let's take two things, like the cat is on the mat. Okay. This is a statement that's either true or false. We look at the cat. Philosopher, not an artist. This is my cat Miller. He's a little bigger than Walter. So there's a cat, and then oh look, a cat is on the mat. The cat. All right. And you look at the cat, you look at the mat, and you'd say, well, the cat's on the mat, right? And then if you look a minute later, then the cat's not on the mat. And it's easy to see whether the statement's true. The statement the cat is on the mat is true if and only if the cat is on the mat. The statement the cat is on the mat is false if the cat is not on the mat. Pretty simple. Now, what about... somebody give me a moral statement, a statement of morality, a moral judgment of some kind. Yes?
Cat shouldn't be on the mat.
Okay. That was something that doesn't involve cats or mats. Yeah.
Stealing is wrong.
Maybe let's take some, maybe I'll get a, how about a variety of statements? Stealing is wrong. How about some particular moral? I mean, you don't go around saying, and this is something that people utter every day, right? People make other, like, I don't know, like I was at this visual effects conference and I was talking with this guy and I probably said something I shouldn't have. So he's like, yeah, we're going to go out and go see the Transformers movie in 3D. And I think I said something like, oh yeah, I already saw a screener on the internet. It didn't seem very good. And he like looked at me with this really serious look and says, why would you do that? And it's pretty obvious that you know he was judging me for looking at an unauthorized copy of a movie that I wasn't sure whether I wanted to see or not. And I that guy said something like, hey, try it before you buy or something. So so he obviously thought, you know,
piracy.
Yeah, downloading. Piracy is such a judgmental word.
Okay.
I'll just put the internet. Piracy is wrong. Anyways, put that. I mean, that's sort of the gist of his statement, right? Or it's wrong to download unauthorized copies of you know, the digital products or something like that. Somebody, I think Blake last time had a good one. Dick Cheney is evil. You could probably add a bunch of political statements at home. You know, all this stuff from Harry, they had the big socialist convention in D.C. last weekend. Harry Belafonte was there, a bunch of socialists and communists there that tried to say that they tried to get as many people there as a Glenn Beck rally and didn't do too well. That's a terrible mess. Anyway, what are some other moral statements? Just throw some. Meat is murder. Some other slogans. What are some other things, like some moral statements, moral judgments? Abortion is murder. That was on the more pedestrian.
That doesn't have a nicer ring to it.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't, no alliteration there. How about something more sort of in a commonplace? Like you make judgments about things every day, right? Mean people suck. Have you seen that bumper sticker? These are all seem to be bumper stickers. Anybody make a moral judgment today or yesterday about something that someone else did or...
Dress is too short.
Okay, sure. Unless it's a statement of fashion or something. Sure, like maybe someone is you know, being promiscuous or dressing in a lascivious manner. So all these things are moral judgment. Now the question is, if you look at the grammar, these look like they're of the same form as the cat is in the mat, right? It looks like you're saying there are these two things and they're related in certain ways. You have the cat in the mat and the cat is on the mat, and that's how they're related. It's a fact. But then if you take something like, yeah, Dick Cheney is evil, or internet piracy is wrong, or meat is murder, what are the facts that... So we know what internet piracy is. We sort of agree on what that is, you know, downloading music and movies without approval from the people that produce those things. But then where does this fit in? I mean, how do we tell whether that predicate applies to the subject or not, and the statement is true or false? Or is evil, right?
Wrong, so, very big. If it wasn't wrong, if it was illegal, it would be a true statement.
So we just consult the law if something's illegal?
No, I'm saying wrong is an abstract word.
Sure.
The definition of wrong, I think, is what you're trying to get at, right?
Yeah, I mean, you raise a good point that it's different. Being wrong seems different from being illegal, in that you can tell whether it's illegal, you just look at the law and see what it says. But there's not a book you can look up to tell you whether something's wrong. There might be books which purport to tell you which things are right and wrong, but nobody can agree on which books those are, right? Some people say it's the Bible, some people say it's the Quran, some people say it's the Bible plus the Book of Mormon, some people say that none of the books are any good, some people say it's Atlas Shrugged, some people say it's the Satanic Bible, right? Everybody's got a lot of people say, well, you know, any one book's not going to help you out. Yeah.
wrong is a judgment, so it'll be different from one person to the next. Like, with internet piracy is wrong in particular, I know people that think that internet piracy is wrong, and I personally don't have a problem with it.
Yeah, so that's... So, now, what Hume says is that this is something in you. It's not a fact of the world. It's a subjective reaction. And so, different people react to things differently. And so, even though it looks like this is a predicate which is applied to an object and it's an statement about objective reality, really it's a statement of subjective preference. It's about what you approve of and what you disapprove of, which is a matter of your feelings. And feelings are neither true nor false, right? If I say I'm sad, that's a statement about me that's true or false. But if I go, right? Is that true or false? It's neither. It's just an expression of how I'm feeling. If I laugh uproariously, or if I break down in tears in the middle of class, that's not true or false. If I pull out my violin and start playing along, right? That's not going to be true or false. It's just like an expression of feeling. In the same way, morality. X is wrong, or evil, bad, means I disapprove of X, or thinking about people doing X makes me feel sad, angry, etc. Or you might say, would that no one ever did X. Might be another way of looking at it. So like my friend who is in the visual effects field, and he spends all day doing movie shots and stuff for movies, right? And he wants to get a job, full-time job working in the movie industry. And so I stole a movie, which, takes away from the bottom line of Hollywood, what internet piracy is, taking money away from Hollywood. And so for him, that's like, it hits him sort of viscerally, because this is what he does for a living, and he sees me as, stealing from the industry he wants to be a part of, and he has some personal connection, so it's almost like I'm stealing from him. The same way if I'm a construction worker and my friend says, I had some work I had to have done in this house, I drove down to the Home Depot and there's like five illegal aliens, I had them jump in my truck and they all worked for like $40 a day. It was great, and I had my sprinkler system redone and reseeded my lawn, and it put me back like less than $200. that person is a construction worker who's seen their wage erode because of all these workers and migrant workers will pay for less that are here illegally, will be upset about that. As opposed to, suppose I'm talking to my friend Juan, who maybe he came here when he was, 1 year old, and his mother is an illegal alien, but he grew up in America, and he thinks about himself as an American, but he doesn't have any papers, and he's worried about, all this sort of anti-illegal immigrant fervor and being sent back to Mexico, where he doesn't speak Spanish and he doesn't feel like he has anything in common with the Mexican people. And so the idea that this might not bother him at all. He might think that, he might believe that the open borders is a good idea, or that there should be amnesty for illegal aliens. So you see, it's the people's personal associations. So what do you think about this as an explanation for what morality is? It's these emotional associations based on individual experiences. And just let me say one more thing, which is that certain things are going to be similar because we have a similar human nature. So Hume thinks that sympathy
is sort of the operative part of morality, which is the irrational association of the sufferings of others with our own sufferings. The irrational association of the sufferings of others with our own past or possible future suffering.
Anybody here see the movie Idiocracy? Remember, it was a show. Anybody want to tell me what was the most popular television show in the future of idiots? Yeah.
Ow My Balls,
right? A TV series which consists of nothing but men being hit in the crotch, right? And if you're a guy, you see somebody be hit in the crotch, you're like, oh, right? Maybe your legs go together a little bit, maybe your hands go down there sort of instinctively. You're like, you see something really bad happen to someone, which you knew if it were to happen to you, it would really hurt. You're like, you wince, right? It's a visceral reaction. I remember one time I was flipping through the channels and I said, oh, what's this? Oh, operation. Ooh, they're doing open heart surgery. That's interesting. Right? I'm like watching, like, ugh. And I'm like watching fascinated. I'm like, oh, I don't feel so well. I started getting sick to my stomach. I had to change the channel because I'd met, and it was totally different from like seeing, you know, Freddy Krueger eviscerating teenagers because it was real. And all of a sudden I felt like really queasy. Why? Because somebody's being, you know, sliced and diced. And I had a friend who actually cut open a artery by accident at a picnic once. And he was just calm. His friend, the EMT, was like, he was an EMT, and he had a guy holding the pressure point. This is like at a church office, and he's like, Jeff, could you hold down your hands underneath my arm so I don't bleed all over the carpet? And I'm like sitting there with my jaw dropping open, you know, and I'm pretty soon I've got blood all over my hands, and it's like, but it's not my blood. Why do I feel like that? Well, it's because I have this squeamishness, and it's sort of a form of association. I think, well, that could have been me, and that's like blood, like I have blood. And there's this irrational association that we have of our own suffering with other people's suffering. We feel compassion. We feel sympathy. And that's really what morality is. It's these non-rational feelings. And this weird thing our mind does where it associates what's happening to somebody else with what has happened to us in the past or what might happen to us in the future. Yeah.
So why does our mind do that?
Good question. What do you think? Do you have an idea about that? Yeah.
We're social animals.
Yeah, I suppose we evolved that way, sure. Blake?
I was going to say that evolutionarily created a response to avoid danger when we've seen danger. If you spend a lot of time with someone who's injured, you probably then participate in the same things that got him injured, and you know, so you have an aversion to those kinds of things.
Yeah, so like, there's something about like, it might be like if you see like a fellow, you know, tribesman eat something poisonous or get bit by a poison snake, you'd want to see like that something really bad happened to that person and that they're in pain or they're going to die because they've been poisoned or bit by a poisonous animal. And if you have sympathy towards that person, you'll think, if that happened to me, that would be really bad. Therefore, I want to avoid that in the future. And so this has some evolutionary advantage, right? To be able to put yourself in somebody else's shoes. And to see, oh, that bad thing happened to that person. I need to make sure that bad thing doesn't happen to me. But as a byproduct, you kind of feel what they feel. Yeah.
So why is it irrational? If it's like a smart way to think about it to make sure that doesn't happen to you, that sounds rational.
That's a good question. It makes sense. Go ahead.
Well, in the initial response is a feeling, and feelings aren't necessarily rational, although you might, you know, rationalize why you feel that way. It doesn't matter, you know, it's still a feeling rather than a thought.
I think the feeling's a byproduct of the good. So I can observe today that something happened to someone without feeling sympathy for, right? And people do this all the time, that they sort of alienate themselves from other people. So when we see someone suffering that we don't... Well, like, think about... people look at like animals, and they're like, that's an animal, it's not a human being, it's not like me, even though it's got eyes and it's got a brain and it can feel pain, and they see it in the little pen, living its own filth, and then they see it like struggling as it's being slaughtered or what have you, and they're like, oh, that's an animal, and that the animals are food, and so I don't care. And maybe it's a shame that animals have to be treated like this, but I'd like my bacon or whatever, right? And so people don't feel sympathy for some people. Most Americans don't really feel sympathy for farm animals that they eat. Some people might feel a little guilty, I guess, but most people don't. But they would feel guilty. They do tend to feel guilty about people around them that are suffering. Although sometimes it might depend on like what the person is like. They might, only certain people maybe. And people tend to care, they say, like, take care of, charity starts at home. They don't care that there's people in third world countries who don't get enough to eat or don't have clean water. They care more about people living in their community. And then, even though the people in their community are, you know, their problem maybe is obesity, whereas people in the third world countries are starving to death. Yeah?
Do you think that maybe it has something to do with the fact that a lot of our dissociation with those feelings is due to the fact that many of us have never actually watched a pig raised and slaughtered and sliced and diced?
Yeah, I could be sure.
I feel like, I mean, yeah, I'm, you know, I eat meat, I love my bacon, I love meat, whatever, but I feel like if I was to go and actually watch a cow get slaughtered, I would feel differently. The same with, like, you know, it's like you see the commercials about the starving people in third world countries, it's like, okay, I feel bad and whatever. You know, however, if I was actually to go and immerse myself in those communities, I feel like I would have a much stronger empathy and sympathy for these people actually being there, seeing it, like, you know, hearing them. And I feel like if it's more real and tangible and, I don't know, it's like it's if everything's kept at a distance, it seems like it's easier to kind of just dismiss it. Like, whatever, I like my meat, you know, whatever, I got my food, I'm taking care of it.
Now, actually, what you say fits really well with Hume's theory. If morality were purely an intellectual thing, it was a matter of true or false and abstract moral principles, then it really wouldn't make that much difference whether you sort of got a visual or whether you had a close social connection with people who are suffering. It would just sort of be, you know, well, here's my duty and here's what I should do. But the, you know, those commercials that show the starving kids affect people, and you know, pictures of animals, you know, stacked yay high, you know, with the waist of the top animal, like the chickens coming down on the bottom animals. You know, when people see that, it affects them. So there's a reason why there's these shocking videos on the internet, and why late night TV shows, you know, the kid with the flies buzzing around and is about to be eaten by the vulture, right? And that's that tugs on people's heartstrings. So Hume would say that just sort of tries to intensify the feeling in order to get you to feel a certain way. But there is no the such thing as like it's true that you should help people in the third world or it's true that you shouldn't. It's just that human beings are naturally sympathetic creatures. And we like to help other people. And that's just sort of part of human nature. And so, now, because we have this common human nature, we tend to approve of helping people in need, helping starving people, we tend to disapprove of stealing and murder, because we wouldn't want to be stolen from or murdered. So those are sort of universal things that you find in almost every culture. There's some idea that you should be helpful to members of your community and help people in need, and that you and that certain things like murder and stealing are wrong. You should respect people's rights in some manner or form. But then, because human beings are so individual and have different experiences and grow up in different cultures, you tend to have also differences between people in different cultures and between different individuals. And so this explains kind of the absolutism, cultural relativism, subjectivism. These all stem from different feelings. The universalism intuition comes from these basic human emotions, which are common to human beings because of our evolutionary history. And then some of the cultural differences depend on the way you're raised and what you're used to, and then the individual differences are based on your individual experiences. So, like, what might be an example where people might have different moral belief based on their individual experiences or different attitudes? Yeah.
You might have someone who grew up in a highly Islamic culture and they think that stealing is really terrible. Or you might meet someone who grew up really poor and, you know, their dad you know, made his money by ripping people off or something. And that's just how they survived. You know, it was the mm-hmm. only way they could survive. So you might have different views on theft from those two different cultures or perspectives.
Right. If you grew up sort of in a maybe a poor neighborhood where, you know, everybody stole and dealt drugs and so on, you might have different attitudes. Sure. What about something else? Some case where you might have differing attitudes based on your background and experiences. Like one person might sort of have one set of experiences, which would cause you either have a positive association or a negative association.
About marriage. I mean, I guess that would more go off of, like, maybe your mom and dad's marriage relationship with them. You know, like, if they had a good marriage, you'd want to possibly get married, whereas if it was always fighting and bickering and divorce, and mm-hmm. like, yeah, screw that, it's not good.
That's a great example. Like if you grew up with a mother and father who stayed together, they had a good relationship, you probably have some positive associations with marriage. And then, on the other hand, like maybe you have that positive model, but then you end up with, like, you know, somebody like my ex-wife, and you had a bad experience, right? Then maybe it might go the other direction. You think like marriage is a bad idea or something, or that it's you sort of, and the same thing about like religion, right? I know this guy. He thought that religion was like the biggest force for evil in the world. And I talked to this guy a little more, and it turns out that he was like, had these crazy parents that had these kooky religious beliefs, were kind of fundamentalists in their view, but also had some kind of wacky beliefs, and like would lock him in the closet for hours at a time in the dark when he was a kid, and abused him in all kinds of other ways, and beat him with a stick, and, you know, and just like, I mean, abused him as a child. And so when he grows up, he has all these negative attitudes about religion. Well, surprise, surprise, right? And almost to the point where it's irrational, where he had this like positive animosity and hatred for all things religious. And I'm like, well, what about, like, you know, all these people that go to third world countries and feed the starving people, and look at, you know, all the major universities and hospitals were started by religious people, and you know, the pilgrims, and he's like, oh, they're just trying to get into heaven, they're just, you know. And it was always some, he had this cynical line about religion, and anything you come up with that was like a positive effect of religion, you come up with 10 negative aspects of religion and how it wasn't really positive, and how all those religious people were mentally ill and, you know, and just horrible from a moral point of view. So, like, another example, and people, this is how racism gets started. I knew this guy. His uncle was tortured by the Japanese in a POW camp. And he's kind of an older guy, so his uncle is back a while. So, he thought that, like, he thought that people of Asian ancestry are sort of robotic and unfeeling, and were trying to take over the world. And he said, well, they tried to take it over, you know, in World War II through military force. Now it's economic, and this was like, you know, kind of like the all the, you know, imports from Asia and stuff. And so he thinks they're waging an economic war on the United States. And all these sort of, you know, really bad stereotypes about Asians based on this, you know, young, impressionable kid hearing these war stories from his uncle about being tortured by the Japanese. So you get these weird attitudes, right? And it's kind of a crapshoot about what you're raised with and how things affect you and how you react to them. And so what Hume says, it's just feelings. And it doesn't make any sense to argue, right? Like if I say I like chocolate ice cream, you say, well, I like Tutti Frutti ice cream. Am I going to convince you that you should like chocolate and you shouldn't like Tutti Frutti? What am I going to say to you? But chocolate, it's so chocolatey, right? You're trying, and you're like, well, but Tutti Frutti, it's so Fruity, right? And this is like, you know, it's a woman's right to choose. You're a baby killer, right? Back and forth. It's just emotional slogans. There's no factual content. It's all emotion, according to Hume. Now, what about some counter arguments or arguments against Hume? What do you think? Does it sound like a convincing view? Unconvincing? Anybody want to speak that and spoken before? Have a criticism or a support? Before I call them the usual suspects. All right, Evan.
I was going to say I'm unconvinced, but...
You are convinced?
Yeah. But a counter-argument. Well, really, you know, with Glaucon and Hume, it seems to be this kind of fundamental idea of, well, are we selfish and evil in our nature and only do good because it benefits us or we don't want to get punished, or are we really, you know, benevolent and caring in nature? And, you know, it's kind of back and forth. So I guess a counter-argument would be, well, we're not that sympathetic, you know.
Yeah, and... Yeah, so some people think that there's this argument between like Hobbes and Hume about human nature. And Hobbes said, of course, everyone's beneficent and sympathetic and honest, and that's why we lock up our valuables at night. Right? And sort of making a joke that, you know, the reason that people have locks on their doors and on their chests of jewels is because, you know, everybody's out for themselves. And Hume actually was kind of a party animal, actually. He was a very social person. He went into philosophy because he wanted literary fame. And he was sort of an affable person. And so maybe this goes along with his personality. This sort of, he was a very, you know, sympathetic person. But what about... It, you know, when you pull up you pull out an ethics journal and you get these complicated arguments about, you know, moral principles, and people talk about their duty. I mean, don't people often do things because it's their duty, even though they don't really want to, and find their duty distasteful and unpleasant, and even it goes against their natural sympathy, right? Try to stay away from the political examples. Meg Whitman, I'll beat up on a Republican for a change. So Meg Whitman had this housekeeper from Guatemala, I think. And the housekeeper, they got like a letter to the house that said, hey, there's a problem. The Social Security number doesn't match the your employee here. And so it didn't say like your employer is committing Social Security fraud. Check it out or something. So she just handed it off to the housekeeper, said, take care of this. I don't know what this, you know. But eventually the housekeeper went to her to try to get her green card, and she's like, what, you're an illegal alien? And once she found out, she fired her. And of course, this is, you know, somebody who'd worked for her for like 9 years, and she felt bad about it, but... She's like, the law is a law. You're not allowed to work in this country illegally. I've broken the law, you know, for hiring you for 9 years, and you're not allowed to work in this country. And so, goodbye, right? Even though this was probably turns out to be personally bad for her, right? It's a big election issue now. She's running for governor of California. I'm from California, so I'm maybe more aware of things down there. But so she's got. So she basically fired this person, even though she felt guilty about it. Why? Because it was her duty. That's what she should do. And don't people do that all the time? They do their duty, even though it goes against what they would prefer, or what they want, or how they feel. They're like, this is what I should do. So that might be an argument against...
So, duty... people act from duty, regardless of feelings. Another one is people. You know, people have moral arguments, and it seems like, is it really that people aren't? If Hume's view is right, people aren't really having an argument. They're just kind of spouting off their feelings.
But it really doesn't seem like that. When people are having like an argument about some, you know, weighty moral topic, it's not like Tutti Frutti versus chocolate ice cream. It seems like there's some issues of substance that are debated in the ethical argument. You look at, like, you know, people argue about stem cell research or capital punishment. You get these complicated arguments based on moral principles and the greater good and human rights and retributive justice you know, just complicated arguments. Is this just, you know, people's emotions? It seems like there's intellectual content to moral arguments.
So that might be another objection.
Yeah. The other thing is that there's no a third thing. So we agree, people act from duty in regards to their feelings. People have moral arguments. And the third one, which I guess I'll put over here, which is that, people have moral arguments. What was my third point here? People act from duty. People have moral arguments. Oh, there's no... It lacks... People say Hume's theory lacks prescriptive force. It's purely a descriptive theory. So it tells you what morality is, but it doesn't tell you what you should do. Now, I suppose it's because it's a form of moral skepticism, right? So, but it's really not enough to kind of tell you what you should do. It just says, well, you got these feelings, and they're a product of evolution. They're part of your human nature. You know, Hume is pre-evolution, pre-Darwin. But he has this general sense of human nature, and that human beings are sympathetic creatures, and that we tend to associate the sufferings of other people with our own suffering. But all Hume says is, yeah, here's why your mind does these things, and here's why you feel this way. But it doesn't tell you whether you should feel like that, or if you, given that you feel like this, whether you should go along with those feelings or try to go against those feelings. So it's maybe not a criticism of theory, but it's a drawback, that this isn't a fully fledged moral theory because it's a form of moral skepticism. And so if you're looking for guidance as to what I should do today, Hume's probably not going to help you out. But I think in another way it might be helpful in that if you think, well, okay, if there's no such thing as morality, should I act like Glaucon? Should I go around robbing, stealing, killing? Well, maybe you should just, you know, go with the way you feel, and that's good enough. You know, why don't you want to stab your friend in the back? Well, because you feel kind of guilty. Are those guilt feelings rational? Well, not really, but it's going to be a lot of work to get rid of them. And maybe, you know, that you like having friends and having these social relationships, and guilt is sort of a part of being part of the moral universe. So that's last word on Hume. Who wants to have the last word on emotivism, if anyone? I'll let you meditate on this. We'll get into religion on Monday. We'll be talking about divine command theory, so make sure to read that chapter. I believe it's chapter 4 for Monday. See you then.
We're going to get a study guide for a video.